The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Well, welcome back. Tuesday, February 27th, 2018. I am Seth Leibson and delighted to welcome to the show and to the airwaves of Phoenix an old and dear friend, Stanley Kurtz. He is a scholar at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. You often read him at National Review as well. I want to say something about Stanley before we get to this topic at hand. The topic at hand is, of course, free speech, particularly on the campuses, college campuses and universities. As you know, this is something we talk a lot about here. As you know, it is the topic of a great event tonight we're doing with Dennis Prager, who is addressing this issue and making a documentary about this. Let me say something about Stanley, our guest. I've known him for close to 20 years. And when there is something interesting, positive, and moving the ball forward going on in the conservative movement, usually it's an idea of Stanley's that is taking hold. And he has done this every few years. He seizes on a new way and a new place to advance the ball. And I suppose I shouldn't say for conservatism so much as I should say for freedom. So, Stanley, thank you for just always being unique and coming up with these really good ideas. And I want to talk with you about the most recent one, which is now having, hopefully, or will soon have an effect in Arizona. Welcome to the show, Stanley.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Seth. Thanks for those two kind words, but I'm very grateful.
You earned them and deserve them. There is a bill, a piece of legislation pending in the Arizona State Legislature. It has passed the House, thanks to our good friend and frequent guest Paul Boyer for championing it here, and the Goldwater Institute for working with you on this. You are going around the country, as I read things and understand things, and Arizona's on the precipice of passing this, doing your utmost to protect free speech on our public colleges and universities. Would you like to say a little bit about the project, how you got involved, and what you're doing?
Sure, Seth. I've been writing at National Review and other outlets about all the problems on our college campuses for about 18 years now, and it was in 2015 when the demonstrations that you and your listeners may remember that happened at Yale over the Halloween costumes and the University of Missouri, when those demonstrations swept over the campuses, I realized that after 15 years of public writing on the universities, I was having absolutely no effect whatever. And not only were things not getting better, they were getting very much worse. And so it was at that point I decided that it was really time to try something new. So I did some research. I looked into the very best statements on campus free speech, statements revered by liberals, really, as much or more than conservatives. And I just tried to incorporate the core elements of those famous defenses of free speech, the Yale's Woodward Report of 1974, the more recent Stone Report of the University of Chicago, and the Calvin Report, I believe, of 1967 from the University of Chicago. I just tried to incorporate all those into model legislation. I was able to partner with the Goldwater Institute right there in Phoenix, and we happened to go public with that legislation on the 31st of January, 2017. And 2 days later, on February 2nd, was the Milo Yiannopoulos riot at the University of California at Berkeley. And after that, a series of shoutdowns, Charles Murray, Heather McDonald, on and on. And I don't always get my timing right, but this was a case where, through no fault of my own, just by happy coincidence, things worked out well, and all of a sudden, the model legislation just took off, and legislators all over the country expressed an interest. I was invited to testify, and the bill began to move. It's actually passed into law in North Carolina. It's cleared the lower house in Wisconsin, and the Wisconsin regents have already adopted it as policy. But there are states where the university fights back In some states, it gets bipartisan support with some Democratic opposition. In some states, I'm sorry to say, the Democrats oppose what really is just standard issue free speech legislation. So it's a battle all across the country. It's an expanding battle. There are other models, but the model that the Goldwater Institute published, that's the one that I co-authored, is the toughest and most comprehensive. It's the only model that deals with these shout-downs. It provides for discipline of the protesters who shout down visiting speakers. It also has a very tough oversight system that is based in the regions, whereas some of the other models just have the administrators report on themselves. So this is the tough bill. It's moving through the House in Arizona and headed for the Senate. And it's a national battle, and we don't know exactly how it's going to turn out.
Hopefully more freedom and more academic and intellectual seriousness at our universities. I want to do a couple things with you on this, if I can, Stanley. One is I wondered if you might give us an overview of what this model legislation is, what the elements are. And then I want to get into a few other aspects of it. But, do you know, just back of the envelope, give the audience an overview of what this legislation would do.
Absolutely, Seth. It does quite a few things. First of all, it bans these speech codes, restrictive speech codes. It bans these so-called free speech zones, the little postage stamp size areas where some administrators say you have to be confined if you want to actually say something about a controversial issue. It makes it much harder for administrators to disinvite speakers who students or faculty want to hear from. It makes it much more difficult to use high security fees as a backdoor way of censoring views that universities don't like. It protects student groups against discrimination because of their beliefs. And this is a particular problem that Christian student groups have run into lately, but the legislation would protect all student groups, regardless of their point of view. And it also
how latitudinarian is that, Stanley? Would this cover the swath of ideology for the most part? I don't mean to be trite, but would it protect a Young Socialist Alliance organization as much as it might protect, I don't know, fans of Milo Yiannopoulos? I don't know. However far to the right or left you want to go. Okay.
No, you're exactly right, okay. Seth, and I can give you an example. I can't remember the exact school, but I remember some years ago, after the 2008 election, Bill Ayers was invited to speak on a university campus.
Okay.
Now, I would never have invited Bill Ayers. No one's obligated to give someone a platform.
Right.
But once you invite someone, you should not disinvite them. And so the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education came to me, actually, because I had helped to inject the Bill Ayers issue into the 2008 presidential campaign. And I actually
That was one of the things I was thinking about when I said, if there's something positive going on, you can thank Stanley Kurtz. I remember that period well, but go ahead. Sorry to interrupt.
Well, so I just, no one could say that I was a fan of Bill Ayers, but I tried to uphold the principle that you should not disinvite a speaker once you've invited them. And so our bill is absolutely neutral with respect to content and viewpoint. It protects everyone. And, of course, young people tend to forget. Young people who are on the left side of the political spectrum often forget that the left has had a great history favoring freedom of speech because freedom of speech is really the best protection for any kind of minority. And so minority rights really are, and free speech should be friendly and historically have been friendly. Unfortunately, nowadays, an apparent opposition has arisen between the idea of free speech and the idea of civility to minorities, but it's really a misunderstanding, I think, because freedom of speech really isn't just about license and freedom, or rather, freedom requires responsibility, virtue, self-control. For me to allow someone whose ideas I hate to speak freely without trying to shout them down, without trying to physically attack them, that is part of freedom as well. So
it should be part of academic study, too, that we should not be afraid of an idea, merely an idea, right?
Absolutely, absolutely.
We're going to a break, Stanley, and I'm wondering, you have a little time for us, right?
Oh, yes.
Can I come back and pick up on this on the other side of the break and also talk to you a little bit about the distinction you have? This only applies, as I understand it, to public universities and colleges, not the
public. That's right.
Right. We'll be right back with more from Stanley Kurtz on how to protect free speech at our college campuses. I'm Seth. He's Chris. He's Stanley. We'll be right back.
You don't know how lucky you are.
Welcome back to the Seth and Chris Show. Talk about great voices. Where would we be without free speech? Well, we wouldn't have country music, which is also a topic Stanley Kurtz has written on, and we can talk about that another time, too. But Stanley Kurtz is with us from the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He's been working with Paul Boyer here in Arizona, chairman of the House Education Committee and the Goldwater Institute, as he has been working across the country to protect and preserve free speech at our public universities and colleges, which is a funny thing to have to say, but I give you the times. Stanley, you grew up and were educated at some of the country's best universities and schools. Did you ever think you would have to make a profession of defending free speech and free thought at the college campus?
I really didn't, Seth. I never thought it would get this bad. There is a mild silver lining to the problem, because those of us who care about universities remember as a kind of golden age the period under President Reagan when Bill Bennett was Secretary of Education, and then followed by Lynn Cheney at the National Endowment for the Humanities. And in those days, there was an active public argument, and the problems of higher education were at the top of the list of public concern. But in the decades following that, I think conservatives in particular tended to just roll their eyes and write off the academy as a little bit crazy, but a little bit irrelevant. And it's only now that things have gotten so terribly bad, and that we face a generation that probably, if it voted on its own, would have made Bernie Sanders president, that people are beginning to realize that the universities need to be taken seriously. So I never thought it would get this bad, but the slight silver lining is at least the problems of the universities have gone back to a first-order concern.
A couple questions about the public and the private and the First Amendment itself. The need for this model legislation that you've co-authored, Stanley, the need for any legislation on this. Why would a public university or the students therein, or the professors for that matter, or administrators therein, not be able to just rely simply on a civil rights suit to defend their First Amendment rights? Why is more legislation needed? Can they not avail themselves of the First Amendment in a public university as is, given the idea that a public university implies state action?
That's a great question, Seth, and it's an argument made by some opponents of these bills. But what you find, for example, in Michigan, where we have a Goldwater-based bill pending in Michigan, Michigan has had a series of lawsuits over free speech zones, unconstitutional free speech zones. In fact, in one of these cases, a student was actually put in jail for handing out the Constitution outside of a free speech zone.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
And what tends to happen is the students who make these cases, they always win, but then the universities just go back and do it all over again. So you would think that a single victory on free speech zone would make all colleges in the country just do the right thing. But instead, they just keep coming down on the students. And not only that, it's really a tremendous burden for a student to have to sue their own school.
Sure.
Either they use their own money,
or
they recruit an organization. But really, who wants to be crosswise with their own school? It makes you frightened of your own career, your future, your friends, your surroundings. It's a terrible burden, and no student should have to go through this just to be able to hand out the Constitution.
Chris here, my co-host in college, as I did on another thing in college, we were in Claremont together at the time. Chris, when you did that thing with flyers on a certain issue, were you ever put in apprehension of being kicked off campus? Did you have to, at certain points, think about hiring a First Amendment lawyer or some kind of lawyer, or was were things not so bad in the late 80s?
I think that's a good question, Seth. They were certainly bad enough. Not what they are today, but they were certainly bad enough that there were things that you couldn't say or do without fear of the death penalty, so to speak. You know, expulsion. Unlike, for instance, what happens with these people who mob people like Charles Murray or Heather McDonald. Right. No, they face no repercussions whatsoever.
That's a very good point. They face few repercussions, if any. And that does raise, because these examples, Stanley, in many cases, are at private colleges and universities, if there has been contemplation on your part to try and get this kind of legislation to affect, or these policies to affect, the private colleges and universities? Or is there a philosophical issue with that?
Seth, and I would mention two particular cases. First, there is the possibility of amending the Higher Education Act condition the eligibility right. of private colleges and universities for federal aid.
Right.
And, of course, there's massive federal aid.
You bet.
If you condition that on free speech. Now, I have favored that, but I'm sorry to say that Congress has not followed through on anything even remotely resembling that.
They're wimps. Let's just say it, right? They don't want to take on the colleges and universities, do they? That's been my experience. I remember this having to go back to the Solomon Amendment. No one wanted to enforce it. You remember? You know what I'm talking about.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Right. And you're absolutely right. And this has been a terrible problem. It's a problem on the state level, but lately we've been having a little better luck in the states. But there's one other example to give here, and that is California. California has something called the Leonard Law, which actually imposes the First Amendment on private schools. No other state has anything quite like that. They do it by threatening state aid. And so there's a version of the Goldwater Campus Free Speech Bill in California. That bill, following the California ordinary practice, actually would apply to both private and public colleges and universities. And this is California, where a great deal of the problems are concentrated. So they do it with private schools by making state aid to higher education conditional on adherence to the bill. So there actually is a state, and it's arguably the worst state with respect to this problem, that where public colleges would be under the gun. But, of course, passing this bill in a state as blue as California is daunting task.
Yeah, I can very much imagine that. What I was wondering, we're heading into a break, Stanley. Can I keep you for one more small segment, one more short segment? One of the things I was hoping you might do, and maybe today's an interesting day to do it. We talked earlier with Charles Kessler about the marking of the 10-year, if you will, anniversary of the passing of William Buckley. Who gave many a speech on a college campus. I don't know if he could today. Not certainly as untrammeled as he did in his day. I wonder if when we come back, you might talk a little bit about how we got to this point where the First Amendment, the notion of free speech, has become so downgraded and such a downmarket commodity. Might you say a word or two on that? Basically the origins, the etiology of this disease when we come back.
Absolutely.
Great. I'm using Buckley words for some reason. I shouldn't be doing that. I'm Seth Leaps, and he's Chris Buskirk. We'll be right back with Stanley Kurtz. Welcome back to the Seth and Chris Show. I'm Seth. He's Chris. We're delighted to have with us Stanley Kurtz from the Ethics and Public Policy Center, who is working to preserve and protect free speech on our college campuses. Stanley, how did we get here? You know, we all thought that if anywhere free speech would be safe, free thought would be safe, it would be in places of higher education and higher thought. Maybe it's that these are no longer places of higher education and higher thought. I don't know. You've spent your life in the pursuit of the intellect and these things. How did we get here?
Well, there are a number of interrelated causes. I think the first one is the well-known entry of the so-called tenured radicals, the new left, into colleges and universities, that is through the faculty. And the new left has never really valued free speech in the height of the 60s, the demonstrators idolized a fellow named Herbert Marcuse, who was the forerunner of the problems with free speech we're seeing on campus today. He really rejected the whole idea of free speech, but the truth is Marcuse was just saying what Karl Marx had said before him, which is the whole idea of liberty and freedom is just a kind of mystification given off by the ruling class to hide their power. And even if people don't focus on it in terms of class analysis, as Marx originally did, when you hear people talking about freedom of speech as being a mystification for, say, white privilege, that really is a kind of neo-Marxist perspective. And it's dominant on campus now, and I think one of the keys to that problem is tenure. The tenure system was meant to protect freedom of speech, but that only works when your faculty actually believes in classic liberal principles. So in the old days, a chairman of, a political science department would call up the best conservative political theorist that he knew and say, who's your best student? I want him. And he would call up the best liberal professor he knew and ask for the best student. Everyone wanted their department to have the best representatives they could find of the different perspectives. But when the new left folks got into the faculty, they used tenure as a way to strangle diversity of thought. That once they achieved a kind of critical mass, through just reproducing themselves with younger professors who thought like them, they were able to choke off the entry of anyone with a contrary view, and that's what we're faced with today.
You know, it's sad to think, but it has to be thought, it has to be said. You know, you and Chris and I were privileged to study under some of these just tremendously world-class intellects when we were in college. You were at Chicago, weren't you?
I
Harvard.
Taught for a while at Chicago,
right.
But I actually was at Harvard,
I wasn't
studying political philosophy at that time. I was, believe it or not, my PhD is in social anthropology.
But I remember that now that you remind me. But my point being, I guess that you know these giants of intellect who walked these campuses and taught there, the Alan Blooms, the Harry Jaffas,
yes,
the Harvey Mansfields. That gave us what we have, and your teachers as well. And I for another time, the story of you and Alan Bloom would be fine. But I know you had those interactions. I don't know that they could present and teach on college campuses today. That's my fear. That's my concern. I don't know that they'd be allowed.
Well, you're absolutely right. But you know, Arizona is pioneering in this regard. In fact, I haven't had a chance to read it fully, but there happens to be a long article in today's New York Times about Arizona having established this new center, run by Paul Carice. So there may be a way in which state legislatures can begin to try to right some of these wrongs. It's controversial, but in my view, it's entirely justified because the abuse of tenure has led to a kind of one-party intellectual state. And at this point, I think the public, through its representatives, has to intervene.
As Flannery O'Connor put it, you have to push back as hard against the age that pushes against you. And that's what we're doing. Thank you, Stanley, for all your hard work. And thank you for spending some of your evening with us here today.
My pleasure, Seth.
We'll be in touch.
Thanks so much for having me.
You betcha. I'm Seth. He's Chris. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth and Chris Show. I'm Seth Liebson. He is Chris Buskirk. Chris, the organization that does its best to defend as much as it can campus free speech, Fire Freedom, you know the organization. It conducted a survey of college students and found that nearly 60% of college students today support banning, censoring, and disinviting speakers they find controversial, speakers they don't agree with. This is just in no way education. I don't know how you get education. I don't know how you get educated if you don't at least occasionally expose yourself to a new idea or an idea that you may not agree with ab initio. I don't know why a college would exist if it wouldn't allow a controversial speaker on campus.
Well, I can think of lots of reasons that a college would exist without allowing a controversial speaker.
This is why I keep you around.
Speaker yes. on campus, for instance, to educate. Right. I mean, they have a job to do, which is to educate people, whether it be in the great books or in mathematics or in science. Those things are their primary job. That is not even in the top 10 of what the universities see as their mission. They are mostly, as our friend Dennis likes to say, they're mostly left wing seminaries. They are there for one person, one proposition, one purpose, and it is not to do what any objective, good faith observer would identify as education. It is to create foot soldiers in the army of the left.
And this, as Stanley was telling us, has a long tradition. Marcuse was perhaps the most modern founder of this notion, but I mean, you control policy by controlling the way people think. We've known this in tyrannical and autocratic regimes for years. Many of them were around when we were younger. We just never thought it would happen here. I mean, this is effectively the taking of glasses, eyeglasses, reading glasses of students and grinding them up like Pol Pot did. This is effectively what they're doing.
Yeah, no, it is malpractice at best. At best, because what they're doing is, you know, we talk a lot about what is citizenship, what does it take to be a good citizen. What the universities do, what their stock and trade in doing, is to make people who are bad citizens, who want to undermine the regime, who are revolutionaries in the worst sense, not revolutionaries in the sense of 1776 fighting for the natural rights of mankind and for a free and just republic. No, these are people who want to tear it all down. These are people who want not to allow other people to speak. These are people who just don't understand what our teacher called the conditions of freedom, right? They're tearing down these conditions, and that always leads the same place, Seth. We see this over and over again throughout human history. When force or fraud are the coin of the realm, and that is the coin of the left. It always leads to political violence and to despotism.
I forgive the students for not understanding this, at least in their freshman or when they first appear on campuses.
I do not, by the way.
Go.
I do not. And I know where you're going with this. I thought,
you know where I was going.
You'd say, well, you know, they're there and they're young and they're impressionable. You know what? They're 18 or they're 19 or they're 20. When people are telling you something that is fundamentally, commonsensically wrong, you have an obligation as an adult to see that and to understand that. I understand as a practical matter why they can be misled. Okay. But, you know, if you are misled by a con artist, but you become a part of the con artist gang, you are still culpable.
Yes, I think I agree with that. What I think I would add to it, though, and you may disagree, is that the professors bear more responsibility because A, they should know better, but B, they are very deliberately.
That is true.
Very deliberately doing this. So that the university has one voice and one thought, in this case, in most cases, leftist. Someone we don't always agree with, and in fact, he wrote an essay we condemned pretty strongly a few weeks ago, but he is a free speech absolutist, is a man at Brookings named Jonathan Rauch, and I always delight in repeating this that he wrote. He suggests that college campuses put in their student handbooks two sentences, warning. Although this university values and encourages civil expression and respectful personal behavior, you may at any moment and without further notice encounter ideas, expressions, and images that are mistaken, upsetting, dangerous, prejudiced, insulting, or deeply offensive. We call this education. Now, I find this smart and amusing, but in vain, because there's no college administrator that would want to put that. They don't agree with him. I mean, this is a solution without a receptacle. There's no college administrator outside of perhaps, I don't know, Hillsdale or a couple other outposts that would actually agree with this. They don't agree that this is education, right?
No, they don't. Right. That's right.
So we're in for this long haul, and I think Stanley's got the right idea with these with this model legislation going through the state legislators. I just find it in its own way somewhat lamentable, if not offensive, that we have to do this, that we have to do this. And I think it really interesting. I did not know about the Leonard Law in California. I looked it up while on the break. It was passed in 92, so after you and I left college.
Just barely.
But, it's interesting. It's something I've thought a lot about, you know, incorporating, you know, the First Amendment to our colleges and universities. If they're getting federal dollars to experiment and research on the things they want, they should be open to all ideas. And I don't know of any other way to do that than to tie their money to the incorporation of the notion of the First Amendment. It has odd implications in some respects, and it wouldn't affect Hillsdale because they don't take any federal money. So a place like Hillsdale would be fully protected. But, you know, maybe the Claremonts and the Harvards and the Yales need this.
They all need it. They all need it. You know, because Stanley made an interesting observation, which I want to think about it. I think he is probably right, which is to say that 30 years ago, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, conservatives did not take the threat from the left on campus as seriously as they should have. I think that's probably right. That feels right. It was kind of youthful indiscretion.
Kind of
there go the kooks in their corduroy blazers, right, with the arm patches on their elbows. It turns out that they were educating generations of Americans and making them into bad citizens.
Probably something we'll hear Dennis talk about tonight. He'll probably say something, or I would think I could hear him say something along the lines of, it is imperative to take any leftist seriously because the society is so open to it. We'll be right back. I'm Seth. He's Chris. 2 hours of pushing. Today is gonna be the day. Oh, a Buskirk song. Okay, fine. We'll end the show with a Buskirk song. I can live with it. I don't have to agree with all the speech. I just have to grant free speech. That actually was the point I wanted to close on with you today, Chris. You know, every time a Democratic Party administration goes into the White House, there are these efforts to do to talk radio what they have done to the college campuses. There are these efforts, you know, to reinstill some form of fairness doctrine so that we cannot have our free speech, because we are doing what the colleges used to do, right? This is why there's Prager University. Why is it so popular? Because it's good, and it's doing what colleges and universities used to do. You were telling us the story of, is it a 16-year-old or a teenager friend of your family's who started watching
PragerU
classes and started doing so as an open-minded leftist, and he is now an open-minded conservative. This is what they're afraid of. But it has fallen on us, the talk radio hosts.
I don't think that's fair, Seth. He's not an open-minded conservative. He sees right and wrong.
Okay.
He's not open to the wrong anymore.
Okay. All right. Well, let me put it this way. I'll end by quoting the person that we had been celebrating earlier today. If I can find the quote real quickly, I hope I can. Bill Buckley, that there is no shame in speaking the truth. And a society that is ashamed of speaking the truth is a society that doesn't deserve to exist. Not a bad note to end on. Hopefully we will see you shortly at the Prager Corolla No Safe Spaces event. And if not, we'll be with you tomorrow. So until then, class dismissed.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.